Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Eat, Sleep, Work, Repeat, a weekly podcast on happiness and work culture. Hello there, I'm Bruce Daisley. Thank you for listening. If you're a new listener this week, I really appreciate you tuning in. It's sort of a weekly excursion into understanding how we can be happier in our jobs. And over the last few episodes, we've really sort of started delving into the science of good work culture. I think I've realised over the last 24 episodes, if we're going to improve work, we need to understand how our brains work. So last week's episode with Cal Newport hopefully gave you inspiration on that. Cal had a really clear system of how we can fix work. Next week, I'm chatting to Stanford professor, the amazing Emma Seppeler. And today's a slight gear change. It's a really nice, fascinating chat with a culture enthusiast, and that's Biz Stone. Biz was famous for one of the public faces of Blogger, and then he became a founder of Twitter. In 2017, after a time away, he returned to work at Twitter, and I chatted to Biz in Twitter's San Francisco headquarters. Our chat is largely about an interest in work, how to improve work. We talk about play. I've got sort of opinions. I think the word play is a bit of a hoax. We should use the word laugh rather than play. I think work should just be a good laugh. I think play makes it sound all a bit hipster. We talk about hack weeks and how sort of hack weeks can be one way to systematize creativity. I think Biz's philosophy is very people-centred. You know, people first, then technology. And so he gives a really interesting perspective on that. And he gives a really great series of stories about the early days when he worked at Google and then how he learned from that to set up the culture at Twitter. It's a lovely chat. Really keen to hear your thoughts. As ever, all of the transcripts are up on the website, which is eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. You can listen to all the episodes there. If you are listening on the new Apple Podcasts app, do slide down the page on show more episodes, and you can give us a 5-star rating. It's like the Uber for your ears. People do complain about underpay in the gig economy, and that's true enough. I'm earning nothing from this. The thing I was really interested in is two things. You describe yourself, revisiting the stuff that you've actually put down. You describe yourself as sometimes like the humanity. When you're a blogger, you describe yourself as the humanity of blogger, you know, like.
Yeah, because it was all PhDs in computer science and nerds. And so I realized that Ev sort of hired me to come to Blogger and be. Before it was social media, I was the social part. Like I was kind of making blogging into this regular thing, because I was incredibly excited about it. I said, why isn't everyone else freaking out that like the internet has now become democratized? Anyone can publish to the internet. You don't need to know how to code. Why isn't everyone freaking out? Like, this is unbelievable. You don't have to know how to make a web page. You just pick a beautiful template and you type in a box. There's your thoughts and your opinions right there for anyone to see. So I went to work at Blogger, and that's where I was sort of bringing guest bloggers into our main blog and just writing blog posts about what you could do with your blog other than like the obvious, how you could use it in work and school and all sorts of things. I was trying to brand it and mainstream it.
Yeah, you know? Because to some extent, like, there's certain companies, aren't there, where their external brand or the way that consume people use their product becomes their brand, right? You know, so like.
We had that for Twitter because we, in the early days, I blogged once a week to everyone who used Twitter, and I just said everything. I was just like an open book. I was like, this week, this broke. We made this new thing. Ev had a baby. People started to felt like they were brought in, part of the family. And then when all these clones came up that actually worked way better than us, they were like, "Nah, we like these guys. Even though they break all the time, we kind of feel like we're part of their group."
It's sort of like organizations trying to wear their culture on the outside, isn't it?
Well, like, it's also like anthropomorphizing a company so that it's like it feels like a person that you like.
And I guess it doesn't fully work at scale, or it doesn't fully work when, you know.
I mean, if you're a nuclear power company,
yeah,
you can't have a folksy, you know, anthropomorphized, like, hey, y'all, we're going to do some nuclear, we're going to make sure it's safe, don't worry about that, but we're going to, you know, we're going to do some stuff, we're going to do some tests, don't worry about it.
And reading it felt like it was sort of a manifestation of your. You seem to like want to have fun at work. You wanted to have laugh at work. You described, and you know, I was interested whether those things all went together because you loved having fun at work, and work seemed to be like a source of amusement and stimulation as much as anything else.
I can't work unless I'm under crisis, like something like, oh my God, something terrible is happening. We got to figure it out fast. I love that. If everything's going perfectly, I'm really bored. And then two, I also, you know when you laugh at a funeral or you laugh in church or something? So then there's the humor that goes along with the critical situation. Like, you're not supposed to be making jokes right now. This is like a serious thing. Of course, that makes me want to make jokes, right? Like, oh, we're screwed. This is the last time we're going to, you know. And so that makes me want to, that makes it even funnier because you're not supposed to be funny. And I always used to say, I mean, I still say it, but I used to lecture this a lot. That I think the new definition of capitalism should be you make a lot of money, you do good in the world while making money, so the idea of a double bottom line, and then you're having fun while you're doing all this. And that, but if you don't have all three, you're actually not successful. Yeah. Right now you're successful if you're making money. But I say add on those other two and add those to the definition of success. And then you're just making a lot of money. You're not successful.
Because I spoke to Patty McCord, who created the Netflix culture document. And and so one of the things I said to her is that the thing that correlates most with happiness, well, with happiness full stop, is having happy friends. But happiness at work is having a friend at work. And I said to her, it strikes me that like the Netflix culture document is this sort of hyper-capitalism where they're not bothered about people having friends at work. And she said, that's right. We're not concerned about that. And so that's interesting.
Because, wait, they wrote about it?
Yeah.
But, I mean, but they're not concerned about it?
They wrote about, they're not necessarily concerned whether you're happy at work. They're just concerned about whether you're doing good work. It's interesting because...
Well, there's a difference between happy and feeling content and proud that you did good work. That's really key. Because if you go home and you feel like you're not working as hard as your peers, or you're just not, you feel like you're not clicking, you're not doing a good job, it really takes its toll on you mentally, physically. You feel depressed, you know. Not to sort of insult Evan Williams, but when I was working for him and we would have one-on-ones, he would ask me, do you really think you're doing your best work? And then, you know, you say, well, you can always do better, right? You can always learn more, and you can always be a better version of yourself and do better and learn more and do better. So I would say, well, I can always do better, so I guess I'm not doing my best work, which means I'm not doing a good job, which means I suck. And I would go home feeling like, maybe I shouldn't even work here. Like, I don't do anything. Like, I'm doing a bad job. Whereas, you know, when I work, like, the opposite, is, you know, it changed when we became peers. But, you know, when I work with Jack, he's just like, this is amazing. You're an amazing communicator. You're amazing at brand. let's work on this together. I think the whole thing you just created is beautiful, awesome, perfect. We just need to change a few words. Let's go over it. I mean, then it makes you just feel like I kicked it out of, knocked it out of the park. Yeah, okay. I feel
so
great.
So you're talking there about different styles of...
Yeah, that's a different version of happiness, yeah. Like a contentness.
Yeah.
And then there's also working, there's also the idea of just working, 4 hours, like a strong 4 hour solid work block. That can be a day. If you get that work done and you really nail it,
there's a couple of questions I wanted to ask you.
And so then I started to... I had imposter syndrome for so long.
Yeah,
okay. And then I realized, wait a minute, I can do things that other people can't do in like a year. I can do them in a week. And so, like, I should feel proud of that. And it's not based on, like, chugging, putting in the hours and working from 7 till 9. It's about the work that you do that's special and good. And it doesn't matter how long it takes.
There's a couple of things I wanted to ask you. One was your first proper job was a design job, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, if you look at Airbnb, a couple of the founders are designers and they seem to be very culturally focused. And you gave an interesting example about design. You said in design, there's more than one right answer. Right?
Oh, yeah. Or there's no wrong answer. Yeah.
Yeah. And so consequently, I wondered whether there was a connection between the worlds of design and the worlds of creativity in that you're always creating stuff, or whether your interest in passion, your passioning for culture came from that, or if they're unrelated. I was interested in exploring that.
I think the design is pretty much related to everything. Design broken down into its first principles is just making choices. Just making a lot of little choices that add up to something that's greater than the sum of its parts. So my first proper job was designing book covers. And you pick a font, you pick a photograph, or you make a piece of art or whatever you do, and you assemble them all together, and each one is a choice, and then they're all layered on, and then it looks awesome. Or maybe it looks awesome, but it's not. Sales is like, I can't move this. I need this to look like Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers, which was a bestseller. We want it to look like one of those books, And so, okay, fine. Back to the drawing. I found joy in designing book covers that were awesome to look at. Sales, were like, yes, we can sell this. And editorial said, this really speaks to what the book is about. And then I would, because my peers were like, they're stupid. This is the greatest design ever. But I was like, you guys, the design is serving a job to be done, which is, will the books fly off the shelves? Is it representative of the content?
Basically,
all that stuff.
If you smuggled a brilliant design through those restraints,
yeah.
You felt like
right.
You sort
then
of
I was like,
the
then I'm like up first on the podium,
yeah.
As opposed to second or third,
yeah.
Because like, there's a lot of really unbelievably great looking designs that never make it.
But I wondered whether it was too tenuous.
You see how it's connected to the regular world, just decisions, like really good. You're designing things when you're deciding things.
But I just wondered whether
and then you can design a culture.
I wondered whether the humanity in design meant that you were always, whether your passion for culture came related to that, or maybe
there's another thing that my passion for culture came from. Yeah, it did come from design, but it also came from a completely failed culture in my first startup.
Right.
And I quit. And then I was...
And you worked at Google there as well.
Before Google, I worked at a company called Zanga, which I started. It was a very early social networking, social blogging service, xanga.com. Pro tip, don't name your company that. That's a name that you then have to spell. It's like a joke. If you have to explain it, it's just not funny. Yeah. So we made that. That had all the things, like all the early sort of progenitors of Facebook. It had all that stuff. It had what I called SMURF, single multi-use rating and feedback systems, which was an e-prop. So if you didn't want to leave a comment, you just gave them a little coin and virtual coin that said, I read your post. And then you would get a link to your... So they would then click on yours, go to your post, and give you one of these coins. And that turned, that had a network building effect. It was like a like, basically. So what happened there was I designed that network with a very empathetic sort of feel, like, what do people want to, what are their personal Zanga diaries going to look and feel like? And you know, people really liked it. People came out on it. People poured their heart into it. I still meet people. It was very popular with Asian Americans in like the late 90s, early 2000s. And I still today meet people like, I had a Zanga. Oh my God, I had a Zanga. Oh my gosh, like I said, such a silly teenager.
Because the culture didn't work.
And so what happened was, yeah, the guys I started with, they had, I didn't graduate college, but they did, and they went into consulting. And then as we got to 1 million users, and that was like, okay, we're growing really fast.
That's numbers, right?
Yeah, that was good numbers. And it was because we added web blogging, which they didn't want to. I was constantly battling with these guys. They wanted to make a site that sort of emulated ePinions, if you recall, in which you would write a review of everything you owned, like books, CDs, whatever. I didn't own anything. I was $75,000 in debt. I was like, I don't own anything, even if I own it, I'm not going to write about my forks. Come on. So I was like, let's let people just write about whatever's happening in their day and their life, their opinions, their thoughts, and then let's let them share it all. And so I finally got them to agree to that. We did that. The numbers took off. People started joining. And then they started hiring all their, like, bros from the consulting world. And I remember, like, the straw that broke the camel's back for me was one of these guys. I had a phone on my desk. I rarely used my phone. I sometimes called my wife and said when I was going to be home, but I rarely used it. And one of these new guys came in and said, you don't use this, right? And as he was saying that, he took it and put it on his desk. And it just, I was like, that was so rude. I've been here for 2 years here working on building this thing from the ground up, and this guy just comes and takes my phone. Like, I it's a silly thing, but I felt like he was just completely being disrespectful. And yeah. I said, you know what? I realized my wife was the one that pointed out to me that I was complaining every time I came home. I was complaining at night. And she was like, I think you shouldn't work there anymore. And then once that got into my head, I was like, yeah, you know what? I just don't like what it's become. Because my original goal was, let's start it in Boston and Cambridge near MIT and hire young engineers right out of MIT, and Boston is where me and one of my other co-founders lived. And they said, no, New York City, because it's cooler, also way more expensive. Anyway, it just, the culture went sideways and I quit. And I realized later, I was too green to realize at the time, I should have worked to fix it.
To fix it, yeah.
I should have given a presentation.
So what would you do today?
So that's what I did at Twitter when we started, when we first created the actual company of Twitter. Like that week, I gave a presentation and I said, we're going to design our culture and we're going to treat it like a product. And for now, I'll product manage it. And these are the things that we're going to believe in, and these are the things we're going to do. We're going to have volunteer days. We're going to have something called Twitter for Good, where we're going to help philanthropic organizations with whatever we can. Maybe we don't have money, but we'll give them our time. We'll help them with Twitter in some way. We'll do whatever we can. You know, we'll have food drives in the office. We'll have clothes volunteer days, and I organize all these things. And that made me feel good because it made me feel like, okay, if I can set the tone to be a place that I really want to work. You know, and then I had these six assumptions, which I can't remember them all now, but they were things like, always assume that your coworkers are smart and have good intentions.
Like, it's like a therapy thing, isn't it?
They went through the same interviews that you went through to get here. So don't assume that since they laid out a plan and then 3 months later that plan isn't as good as they laid it out, that they're bad at their job. You know, go up and say, you know, what happened? How are you blocked? And how can I help you? Because guess what? You're going to have a time when you're going to present something, and your project isn't going to turn out right either. And it's not your fault. It's just that there's things, life gets in the way, and you know, you scope it down and turn it out to what it turns out to be. And I mean, occasionally, yes, you should fire a person. They are not good at their job, but you shouldn't assume that from the beginning. Yeah. You know?
It's interesting what you say there about culture being the tone of a company, because that seems to be really clearly the truth for me.
It's like how you behave to other people. If you were a person, it's like your character. Do you have integrity? Are you funny? Like, we used to even hire for funny. We would be like, was the guy funny? Or was the woman funny? Did she seem like she had a sense of humor? Because you got to have a sense of humor to work at this place.
That's one thing I've really been fascinated with. Because one of the things, when you study a lot about sort of good culture and good environment, you get this word play coming. And the danger with play as a term is it seems so trivial that other people are very easily able to criticize it.
Yeah.
And play, to some extent for me, just means having a laugh at work, or you know,
the word play is extremely significant. Every living animal on earth learns through play. You see lion cubs, you know, tumbling around and biting each other and scratching each other, and they're learning how to hunt.
My point is, when it comes to describing it in a modern workplace,
yeah, then they think about foosball, right?
Yeah,
but that's not what we mean. We mean like play, you know, have fun, like do something crazy, like. I remember when we were first designing Twitter, I said, you know, it'd be really funny. And I laughed out loud. I said, what if every time you made a tweet, we made a permalink, we made a whole webpage just for that tweet. And I presented it, and it was in the font Georgia, and it was just huge. It was like 24 point or 32 point Georgia, because it was just a tweet and I had to fill up the page. So it was this gigantic text, and I laughed, and I said, look how silly this looks. But we kept it, because permalinks were good, because we wanted people to be able to link back to a tweet somebody said. And over the years, it got more refined. But it came about as kind of a joke, like, check this out, you guys. Same thing with the bird. I drew a bird just because I wanted to draw a bird. I wasn't actually even thinking strategically. I saw that someone else had drawn a bird, and I was like, wait a minute, I know Adobe Illustrator. I wonder if I could draw a bird while everyone's at lunch. And I drew a bird, and I was like, I showed it to Ev. I was like, hey, check it out. And he was like, that's cool. And I said, I drew it. And he was like, oh, nice. Good job. And I was like, wait a minute, Twitter. Why don't we have a bird for our logo? And that's when I realized, like, I sent it to a friend who's more a better illustrator than I am. And he, you know, turned it into the little bird, the little hairdo.
Yeah.
And then later on, we streamlined it. But yeah. You know, it was play. That was all from play. And even the Twitter itself was a hack week project that Jack and I decided to just play around with. Like, could we get SMS to communicate with the web and the web to communicate with SMS? Let's just see. Let's just play around with that.
Because that was like at a time when there was an existential threat to the organization that you were working at.
No, our organization was falling apart. We were trying to sell it. And Ev made the call of just, hey, everybody, I'm going to try to find a buyer for this podcasting company that we had started in 2004 or 2005. I'm going to try to find a buyer in the meantime. Just skeleton crew on Odeo, and the rest of you just pair up and make a project. And Jack and I had become friends, so we paired up and we made Twitter. And it was play.
Yeah.
We had a play. We literally had a playground right outside our office.
It sort of loops back, because when you, like, if you look at the stats about people at work, half of all people say they are lonely at work. These big stats about people feeling exhausted at work, which I think is a reflection of, if you're living on adrenaline and cortisol and sort of you're injecting stress into your life by checking emails all the time, then it's certain that you feel exhausted.
If you feel exhausted, see, you should feel energized. I once went to a lecture by a famous designer named Milton Glaser, and he said, if you spend an hour with someone, whether it's a dinner, an interview, a baseball game, whatever it is, and after that hour you feel exhausted, that's probably a toxic working relationship. But if after that hour you feel energized, then that's probably a good partner to work with. And so I always thought, I always, when I did interviews, I was always like the closer. Yeah. And if I felt like perked up after interviewing someone, I was like, we got to hire this person. Yeah. This person's great. And the same thing is true. I mean, I love my family and I love spending time with my family. But when I wake up in the morning, I'm like, I get to go into Twitter today. Yeah. It's going to be awesome. I love it. I love all the people. I love all the things that I get to do. And if you don't feel like that, then either you need to try to figure out how to fix it, or maybe you just shouldn't work here, you know? You should find a place that you wake up in the morning and you're like, I can't wait to go to work.
Yeah. It feels like you sort of what you said about your one of the first jobs where you were sort of coming home and you're unhappy and there was yeah. sort of, you
know, anger. Yeah,
yeah. It's finding the place between those two things.
Constantly. At first, I loved it because I was building things and making things and people were starting to use them and flock to them, and I was noticing their behavior and adapting the service to give them what they wanted so they would be even happier. Making those people happy made me happy. And when I quit, I felt like I was on the wrong side of the screen is what I felt like. I was like, oh man, why did I quit? And so I worked at Wellesley College for 1 year helping the teachers use blogging and in their classrooms, which was really great actually. But then Google came calling and said, we want you to work on Blogger that we've just purchased. And I was like, okay, well, I'll go there.
What was the culture like at Google at the time?
Oh, it was an amazing culture. I mean, it's funny about Google is they present play everywhere, but they don't really do it. Hmm. Their culture goes like this. It's an ordered list. It's a simple ordered list. And it's backwards of my ordered list. Their ordered list goes like this. Number one, technology. Number two, people. So they're like, they make something and they give it to the people. People don't like it. They're like, fine, let's make this. People don't like it. Fine, let's make this. People don't like it. Fine, let's make this. People don't like it. Fine. They don't get into the people and say, I wonder what the people want and how we can help them achieve that. You know, they struck gold when they... Basically, what Google did was it fixed the internet. The internet was growing so rapidly that there was no way to... Yahoo had a directory, but then that fast became like unusable. You couldn't... It was growing at such an unprecedented rate that there's no way to have a good directory. So Google just said, forget the directory. We'll just find you the relevant page based on keywords. And then it was like magic. I remember the first time I used Google, I was like, oh my gosh, it just instantly brought me exactly the right thing. So... it fixed the internet. It made the internet usable.
And what was it like to work there then? So, because you went on as the acquisition of
Yeah, so I went there, and it was amazing to work there because everything was brightly colored, and there was toys everywhere and balls everywhere, and there was a volleyball court in the middle of the Googleplex. When I got there before the Googleplex, and then they built the Googleplex, and then they built all kinds of other buildings. But people, it wasn't necessarily physical play, but they were playing. They were just experimenting like crazy. You know, I would walk around for fun, just opening doors, and you know, I would walk in. I walked in on somebody who was sitting on the floor barefoot with all these wires and DVRs and TVs everywhere. I said, "What are you doing in here?" And he said, and he just looked up sort of like as if he had been awake for like 48 hours, and he was like, "I'm recording every TV show airing at the moment in the world." And I was like, okay, carry on. And you know, I would go into another room,
like Twilight Zone.
Yeah, I mean they were just doing all these crazy things, like, we want to organize the world's information, like, and TV is one of them, you know. And then I went into another room and there was all these people on these weird contraptions with like a light over them and stepping on a foot pedal, like an old-fashioned sewing machine, and a glass table in front of them, and I was like, what's going on in here? And somebody said, we're scanning every book ever published in the world. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of books.
I mean, it must have been tempting just to keep opening doors.
It was amazing.
Yeah,
it was real. And then I would find somebody, like, I found this guy named Misha. He was a Russian programmer, and just, he was always just doing weird stuff. Like, I don't know what his real job was, but he was like, bis, I have no idea for clock, okay? it's a straight line and did it, and he would, I forget what it was, but he was like invented a new way of telling time. And then I was like, that's really cool. Let's take it to Ev. And we brought it to Ev, and Ev was like, what happens when it's 1 o'clock? And he immediately found a flaw. Like it like didn't work when it was 1 o'clock somehow. And Misha was like, this is a bug. Okay. And I was like, Misha, what did you even do? He's like, I'm very smart. I do my job 10 minutes. It's over. It's easy. I spend the rest of it. And he would just clasp his hands behind his back and walk around. There was another guy who would just juggle like for a good 2 hours every day outside. And his name was Voldemort. It was a lot like the Harry Potter bad guy.
Yeah.
And he was a really kind of weird guy. Like, I would go up to him and I said, don't you feel kind of strange just juggling in your crazy outfit in front of everybody, like, all day long? And he was like, no, why should I? And I went in on the weekend one time and he was just plastering the walls with pictures of Mars. And I was like, did you take these pictures? Thinking maybe he somehow had a super powerful telescope or something. He's like, no, I just like Mars. And they were all over. Like, and he, you know, he was just a weird guy.
So just sort of finish.
So there was a lot of play.
Yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So to finish off, just, you know, the one thing you've mentioned there is, you know, trying to be the humanity of a company and the fact that you love playing, laughing at work. Yeah. Is there any other things that you think, you know, you've just returned to Twitter, haven't you, this year? Is there any other things that you think either here at Twitter or sort of elsewhere that you think are vital parts for good culture?
One of the vital parts that we brought back is tea time, local tea time. Not a global thing, but...
Do you want to explain what that is?
Well, tea time, it started out as, we call it tea time because I said we should copy Google in that every Friday we should stop work and gather around and talk about the week. What did we ship? What went wrong? And if anyone has anything interesting to show us, whether it's their own work or some other people's work outside that they find inspiring or interesting, whatever, let's show it. Let's do it. And Jack said, great, we'll do it at 4:05, which is tea time. So I'll make tea for everyone. And I bought beer and put it in the fridge. And so everyone just drank the beer. So we call it tea time, but everyone drinks the beer. There's no tea. So we brought back tea time. We originally did it every Friday, and then when Dick became CEO, he sort of made it like, I don't know, some every other Thursday globally so that everyone could tune in through a stream or whatever. And I said, everyone just do it your own local tea time on Fridays and be a group. And that's really important because it gets people seeing what happened that week and then... social hour afterwards where you can talk. I can talk to some sales guys that I never would talk to any ever in my normal daily work. So that's important. It's important to like have fun and make fun of a lot of the leadership team. You know, everyone's like, oh, it's Jack Dorsey. Like, oh my gosh, I better look away. He's like, I can't sit next to him. He's so important. And, you know, I just take the piss out of him all the time. And he loves it. He doesn't, you know. Like, just the last tea time, you know, Hack Week starts this week. And so on Friday, I'll show you the video. On Friday, I hired an internal filmmaker. And specifically to make films to show at every tea time. Some of them funny, some of them, whoa, I didn't know we even did that. That's amazing. I didn't know we fought the Department of Justice and won so that they couldn't put a gag order on our transparency reports. Like, that's amazing. Like, that's a trailblazing thing. Or, like, I didn't know we had a Neighbor Nest, which watches low-income single mother's kids while they learn the computer. Like, this is, like, tear-jerking, like what this woman was able to accomplish because of us. And so I want to make all these films so that people realize this is Twitter, you know? Be proud. Feel proud. And the video that we made last week was just a hilarious video, basically explaining what a hack is, and then explaining at the end, you know, Twitter was born from a hack week. It's in our DNA. It's very important that we do this every year because it's part of our culture. It's part of our DNA. And so do anything you want. You don't have to fix a bug. You can do anything you want, whatever you want. So I wanted to drive that home to people. We were born from a hack. So go crazy and make any hack you want. I have a hack too, which is...
I
think it's going to win.
Yeah.
Mine's going to win. Mine's the best one.
And so anyone can do that for the whole week?
Yeah, anyone who signed up to make a hack. And then what they did was they pitched and recruit. They pitched and recruit last Friday, on Friday. And what they do is they say, this is my hack, and we need iOS developers and a back-end engineer to join us. And then you can join the team that you like. If you didn't make your own team, you can still join a team.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of great hacks put forth. And then all this week, people are just going to work on their hacks. I mean, not everybody chose to do it, but hundreds of people are going to work on hacks, and we're going to make a film out of it, and they're going to be judged, and there's going to be like trophies given out, and then there's going to be a People's Choice Award, and then maybe one of these things makes it into actual Twitter if it's a Twitter thing.
What I like about it is that how these people realize if I'm going to make my hack win, I need to build a tribe. And so you've just got like someone who's had this idea that they've been carrying around for weeks and months and years. And
I've had this. My hack is an idea I've had since 2002.
Right.
And I finally realized how it could be put into Twitter, because alone, I don't think it would ever get the traction or it would never work as a standalone thing. But once if it were to be built into something that hundreds of millions of people just use every day, now we're talking.
And that's it. So, like, the building, getting two or three people who can help.
Yeah, it's
and
really
then building
fun.
A movement.
I mean, it's amazing because we have Hack Week, and like, if your thing relates to Twitter at all, you have scale already. Mm. Which is really awesome. You know, like, getting scale is the hardest thing to do when you're building a new app.
Fantastic chat with Biz there. Next week, we've got more science. We're chatting to Emma Seppala, who's got a really clear idea about how can we combat exhaustion at work? How can we combat the sort of the feeling of being overwhelmed? So if you are interested, do tweet us. More than anything, I want to hear from people who feel like they've got boring jobs. I want to hear from people who feel like they've got something to share and we can help improve their job. So please do get in touch. You can find us on Twitter, Eat Sleep Work Repeat, or contact us via the website, eatsleepworkrepeat.fm. Thank you for listening.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.